Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and I'm the Medical Science Officer at Medicom. Today, I'll be talking about six of the presentations from the American College of Cardiology, or ACC, which was held virtually and in person in Washington, D.C., USA this year, between the 2nd and the 4th of April, 2022. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
The Phase 3 Pac-Man AMI trial was presented by Professor Lorenz Reber from Bern University Hospital in Switzerland. And this was looking at the PCSK9 inhibitor alirocumab and adding that to high-intensity status therapy shortly after an acute myocardial infarction, and whether that promoted coronary plaque regression better than statin therapy alone. So this Phase 3 Pac-Man AMI trial was simultaneously published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA. And Professor Reber explained that the unmet need being addressed by Pac-Man AMI was that it is not well known what the impact of PCSK9 inhibition might be on plaque characteristics contributing to myocardial infarction, and in particular, whether the lipid content and fibrous cap thickness are affected by this inhibition. Pac-Man AMI randomized 300 patients with acute ST elevated myocardial infarction, or STEMIs, and there were 53% of those participants at that, or non-STEMI, and that was 47%, who had undergone successful percutaneous coronary intervention, or PCI, of the culprit vessel, and in whom at least two non-infarct related arteries had been found with non-obstructive arterial sclerosis, and that had to be 20% to 50% of the diameter stenosis. Half the patients received subcutaneous 150 milligrams per milliliter alirocumab, and half the patients received placebo starting within 24 hours after PCI and then every 2 weeks for 1 year. Only 12% of the patients were on statins at baseline, and LDL cholesterol level was greater than 125 milligrams per deciliter in statin-naive patients and greater than 70 milligrams per deciliter in statin-treated patients. The primary endpoint was percentage change in atheroma volume. At baseline and 1 year, participants had coronary plaque characteristics in the non-infarct-related arteries assessed using intravenous ultrasound, near-infrared spectroscopy, and optical coherence tomography. The primary endpoint at 1 year was met, and a significantly greater reduction in atheroma volume was measured in the alirocumab arm compared with placebo at 2.13% versus 0.92% reduction. Furthermore, while no differences were seen between trial arms in all-cause mortality and myocardial infarctions, there was a significant reduction in the non-infarct-related revascularization in the alirocumab arm with 8.2% versus 18.5%, which was a significant number. Evidence of PCSK9 inhibition was observed in the one-year LDL cholesterol reduction, which averaged 50.7% in the placebo arm versus 84.8% in the alirocumab arm. Key secondary endpoints also favored the alirocumab arm. The maximum lipid core burden index within 4 millimeters was significantly different, as well as the fibrous cap thickness. Professor Reber noted that the changes were greatest in patients with the lower on-treatment LDL cholesterol levels of less than 50 milligrams per deciliter, which suggests, quote, that we should achieve very, very low LDL levels in our patients at very high risk. Safety results were similar in both trial arms, although there was a slightly higher occurrence of general allergic reactions in the alirocumab arm at 3.4% versus 0% in the placebo arm. Professor Reber suggested that the findings of Pac-Man AMI could be useful in counseling patients with arterial sclerosis. Now let's talk about transcatheter valve repair with the PASCAL system, and this was tested in the CLASP TR trial, which was presented by Dr. Adam Greenbaum from Emory University School of Medicine in the United States. I think that's in Georgia. So these were the first interim results of the CLASP TR trial, and it's a prospective single-arm multi-center study designed to evaluate the safety and performance of the PASCAL transcatheter valve repair system in patients with symptomatic severe tricuspid regurgitation, or TR. The primary endpoint was the composite of major adverse events at 30 days with a follow-up at 6 months, 1 year, and every year thereafter until 5 years. The analysis presented by Dr. Greenbaum was limited to the follow-up results at 1 year. The primary outcome of CLASP-TR was safety, namely lack of adverse events from either the device or procedure, and key secondary events were improvement and reduction in the TR grade, the New York HA functional class, the 6-minute walk test, and quality of life. Of the 65 patients who received the PASCAL transcatheter valve repair system, only 46 had complete one-year follow-up data as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And among those 46 individuals, 7 died, so that's 10.8%, 12 were rehospitalized for heart failure, that was 18.5%, and 11 had experienced a major adverse event, and that was 16.9%. All 46 patients achieved a reduction in at least one grade in their TR severity, with 75% seeing a reduction in at least 2 grades, and 86% achieving an overall grade of moderate or less. Significant improvements were also observed in heart failure severity, the 6-minute walk test, and patient-reported quality of life. Professor Greenbaum said, quote, at one-year follow-up, the repair procedure appears to be safe and significantly reduced the severity of patients' tricuspid regurgitation and improved their ability to function in daily life, maintaining gains that we previously saw at 30 days of follow-up, end quote. The study limitations were low treatment numbers and an absence of a comparator group. In the randomized Class 2 TR trial, we'll compare outcomes for patients treated with PASCAL and those receiving optimal medical therapy with diuretics. The DIAMOND trial was a phase 3 trial, and it was presented by Professor Javed Butler from the University of Mississippi in the United States. So these initial results were looking at whether heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or HFrEF, patients taking renin-angiotensin aldosterone system inhibitors, RAS inhibitors, had significantly lower serum potassium levels when adding the potassium binding agent patiromer to their regimen compared with placebo. DIAMOND was designed to determine whether this patiromer could favorably impact potassium control in patients with HFrEF and hyperkalemia. And the whole goal of this was to be able to optimize the RAS inhibition use to prevent cardiovascular events once the hyperkalemia is under control. Patients with HFrEF and hyperkalemia were randomized to patiromer, and that was 439 patients, or a placebo, also 439 patients, after an initial run-in phase during which all patients received patiromer. Due to COVID-19, the trial's original primary endpoint, which was the time to cardiovascular death or first hospitalization for cardiovascular event, had to be changed. The supply chain for patiromer was actually uncertain during the pandemic, and there were concerns about the ability to closely monitor patients, Professor Butler explained. The researchers decided to shift the primary endpoint to a laboratory value, namely the treatment's effect on serum potassium levels. The study met this revised primary endpoint, and patiromer led to a significant mean reduction in potassium levels by study end versus placebo, with a reduction of 1.3 units. The incidence of hyperkalemia was 13.9% in the patiromer group compared with 19.4% in the control group, which was again significant, and that led to the hyperkalemia-related outcomes win ratio of 1.53. Importantly, patiromer allowed 85% of participants to be optimized on guideline-directed medical doses of RAS inhibition with a use score win ratio of 1.25. Furthermore, as a secondary endpoint, 21.6% of participants on patiromer needed to reduce mineral corticoids as compared with 26.7% of those assigned placebo, with a hazard ratio of 0.74. In conclusion, the data from DIAMOND really do indicate that patiromer was able to maintain lower serum potassium levels and was associated with a lower incidence of severe hyperkalemia compared with placebo. It is yet to be determined whether this intervention results in a reduced incidence of cardiovascular events. This was a talk that got lots of attention. It was about the potential of dietary interventions using supermarkets and in-aisle education to patients and improving nutrition education. And this was demonstrated actually by the positive findings from the supermarket and web-based intervention targeting nutrition trial, which had an attractive abbreviation of SuperWin, presented at the ACC Scientific Sessions. So this was a first-of-its-kind kind of trial, and the results were presented by Professor Dylan Steen, or in Dutch we'd pronounce it Steen, from the University of Cincinnati in Ohio, the United States. SuperWin was a randomized controlled dietary intervention trial, collaboration between academic teams and the Kroger Company, which is the largest U.S.-based supermarket chain. 267 patients were included from the University of Cincinnati Health Primary Care with at least one cardiovascular risk factor, either obesity, hypertension, and/or hypocholesterolemia. After meeting with the University of Cincinnati Health primary care physician, participants completed a medical nutrition therapy visit with a Kroger Health dietitian. Eligible participants were then randomized at their preferred supermarket into one of three study arms. 1, standard of care plus individualized point of purchase nutrition education, and there were 6 visits planned into this, and that was called Strategy 1. The second strategy was a standard of care plus individualized point of purchase nutrition education enhanced with online shopping technologies and training. Again, 6 visits were planned, and that was called Strategy 2. And the last arm was the standard of care alone, which was just letting people shop. Educational sessions within each store's clinic and aisles emphasized the dietary approaches to stop hypertension using the DASH diet. The primary efficacy endpoint was the mean change in DASH score, as they call it, from baseline to 3 months, which was considered post-intervention. Additional outcomes included blood pressure, lipids, weight, purchasing behavior, food literacy, and intervention feedback. The results actually showed a change in DASH score from baseline to 3 months of 8.6 in the Strategy 1 group, 12.4 points in the Strategy 2 group, and 5.8 in the control group. So there was a statistical difference between Strategies 1 and 2, as well as Strategy 2 and the control, meaning that any kind of intervention helped, but especially the online supported by personal education helped. Participants in both Strategies 1 and 2 received in-aisle advice from the Kroger Health dietitian and showed better adherence to a DASH diet than the control group. Participants in the Strategy 2 cohort who were trained on new technologies had an even greater adherence improvement to the DASH diet than those in other cohorts. However, no significant change was observed in the secondary endpoint of systolic blood pressure from baseline to 6 months. In brief, participants in either strategy arm who received an in-aisle education from a Kroger health dietitian had a greater increase in their adherence to a DASH diet than the control group, Dr. Sting concluded. Quote, the participants were taught to shop better, right in the aisles of their own home stores, based on each individual's unique tastes and needs, end quote. This was presented by Professor Ellen Taita from the University of Alabama in the United States, and it was the presentation of the Chronic Hypertension and Pregnancy Trial, with had an abbreviation of CHAP, and it was aimed to assess the safety and efficacy of avoiding adverse pregnancy outcomes by treating pregnant women with mild chronic hypertension. Professor Taita pointed out that this is the largest, most diverse study conducted in pregnant women to date to address this major clinical question, which has been debated actually for decades. The results were presented during this late-breaking clinical trial session of the American College of Cardiology, and it was also published simultaneously in the New England Journal of Medicine. 2,408 women were enrolled. Pregnant women were enrolled who were pregnant with a single fetus at less than 23 weeks of gestation, and they were randomized to receive either antihypertensive treatments recommended for use in pregnancy, which was the treatment group, or no treatment at all except for the case of severe hypertension, in which case the ladies had to achieve a systolic pressure of greater than or equal to 160 milligrams of mercury, or diastolic pressure of greater than or equal to 105 milligrams of mercury in the control group. The primary efficacy endpoint was a composite of preeclampsia with several features, medically indicated preterm birth of less than 35 weeks of gestation, placental abruption, or fetal or neonatal death. The safety endpoint was birth weight falling under the 10th percentile for gestational age. Both the efficacy and safety endpoints were met, and in the treatment group, 30.2% of women had experienced an efficacy primary outcome event, as opposed to 37% of pregnancies in the control group with a hazard ratio of 0.82, highly significant. Importantly, this benefit was not coupled with the negative impact on the gestational age birth weights, and the incidence of babies falling under the 10th percentile for gestational age birth weights was 11.2% for the treatment group, compared with 10.4% for the control group, which had a risk ratio of 1.04 and was not significant. The treatment group also had modestly reduced incidence of serious maternal complications at 2.1% and 2.8%, respectively, with a risk ratio of 0.75, and severe neonatal complications at 2.0% versus 2.6%, respectively, with a risk ratio of 0.77. Furthermore, the incidence of any preeclampsia favored the treatment group at 24.4% and 31.1%, respectively, with a risk ratio of 0.79, and the incidence of preterm birth was 27.5% in the intervention group and 31.4%, respectively, with a risk ratio of 0.87. The take-home message from this trial is that treating pregnant women with mild chronic hypertension produces better pregnancy outcomes than a strategy of reserving treatment for only severe hypertension with no increased risk of low fetal weight, which is actually great to hear that this has finally been set to rest. This was a new analysis of the SCORT trial, which was presented by Professor Deepak Bhatt from the Brigham and Women's Health Hospital in the United States. And this was looking at the SGLT1 and 2 inhibitor sotagliflozin, and it looked at its risk reduction in major cardiovascular adverse events, or MACE, in patients with type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, or at high risk for cardiovascular disease. The SCORED trial compared the treatment of sotagliflozin with placebo in 10,584 patients with type 2 diabetes and chronic kidney disease. The primary endpoint was the risk of complex events such as cardiovascular death, heart failure hospitalization, and emergency room for heart failure. And this was met. It was published last year, showing that sotagliflozin did reduce the risk for these cardiovascular outcomes. At this year's ACC Scientific Sessions, Professor Bhatt presented a pre-specified secondary analysis of the SCORED results, looking specifically at the 16-month effect of sotagliflozin versus placebo for the combined incidence of total MACE events, which included cardiovascular death, first and recurrent episodes of non-fatal myocardial infarction, and non-fatal stroke. The new analysis compared the 5,144 randomized participants who entered the trial with a history of cardiovascular disease with the 5,441 participants without cardiovascular disease history. Cardiovascular disease history included myocardial infarction, stroke, coronary revascularization, and peripheral vascular disease. The incidence of MACE, including first and recurring events, total myocardial infarction, non-fatal as well as fatal, and total stroke, again non-fatal and fatal, was reduced in patients with a cardiovascular history treated with the sotagliflozin by up to 23%. These cardiovascular benefits were consistent in a subgroup analysis in patients with preserved left ventricular ejection fraction, HFpEF, and those who with reduced left ventricular ejection fraction, HFrEF. In those without cardiovascular disease history, sotagliflozin reduced the risk of total cardiovascular events by 26% compared with placebo, indicating that the effect was similar. Likewise, the outcomes for total myocardial infarction and total stroke were similar. Sotagliflozin lowered the risk of myocardial infarction by 31% in CVD history patients compared with placebo, and in those without CVD history, treatment with sotagliflozin did not achieve statistical significance, but it did lower the risk by 34% compared with the placebo. The reduction of MACE was consistent across patients with coronary artery disease with a hazard ratio of 0.79, cerebrovascular disease, and that was a hazard ratio of 0.72, and peripheral arterial disease, and that was a hazard ratio of 0.77. In a meta-analysis of MACE in 4 sotagliflozin studies with a placebo comparator, totaling 20,292 patients, Professor Bhatt noted that sotagliflozin reduced the risk of MACE in 21% with a hazard ratio of 0.79. He concluded, quote, "These benefits showed a significant difference from the placebo group from the third month of treatment," end quote, he said. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I'm sorry that we've run out of time now, but I hope you learned something from the American College of Cardiology 2022. Stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.